Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yinhu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 3, Hunterdon Handmade, August 28th, 2013. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode are located on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. You can find me on Ravelry and Twitter as Sarah Pomegranate. I welcome your suggestions and comments about the show. This week, I heard from new listeners Lara and Allie Jo. Lara left the following reply to episode 2, Longtime Listener. Listening is a whole lot like breathing. We do both involuntarily and mindlessly, but we're not actively or fully doing either until we think about and practice these essential skills. Love the episode and all the enriching resources you provided. Thanks for that comment, Lara. I've been thinking about listening and also introverts and extroverts all week. And it's interesting how when you have something on your mind, items that come up in the news or items that you read are suddenly connected with that topic. Lara has an Etsy shop called Audrey Knitted. If you have a chance, you should check it out. Today's episode features segments titled Backstory, Yarn Lover at Large, The Back Porch, The Front Porch, and Double Happiness. Backstory. One of the things that folks often talk about when they meet someone who practices a similar craft is they tell the story of how they started to do that craft and how they learned it, who their mentors are, and things like that. And also in listening to podcasts, I really enjoy understanding, especially in the early episodes, where the podcaster is coming from in terms of talking about a particular area of interest or expertise. And so this is my way of telling the story of how I came to be a knitter and a spinner and involved in the fiber arts and how I became interested enough to start doing this podcast. In order to give you the full story, I need to take you back to my childhood, and my upbringing was in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. It's not what most people think of when they think of New Jersey. It's an incredibly rural part of the state. A lot of farms and farmland and horse farms as well. Both of my parents grew up in Hunterdon County. They were involved in farming and gardening in various degrees, and so they instilled in all three of their daughters an appreciation for doing things by hand. My parents had at their command an extensive knowledge of how to do things themselves. Just to list a few. This is not an exhaustive list, but just to list a few of the things my parents were involved in when I was growing up. My late father was a carpenter, a cabinet maker. He was also a gunsmith. He built period guns by hand, black powder guns by hand. He did leather work, various kinds of painting and design on pieces of furniture and also small household items. My parents were tenants on a small farm along the Delaware River when I was growing up. And among the various things they farmed, my father was skilled at caring for pigs, rabbits, ducks, geese, chickens, turkeys. He also kept and hunted with a pair of beagles. My mother was an excellent seamstress, and one of my earliest memories is playing on the floor in the dining room of our home while a bunch of young women stood around on our dining room chairs in their bras and slips, and they pulled on bridal gowns and bridal dresses, and she knelt on the floor and pinned up the hems of all of these dresses. During the time that I was growing up, she must have sewn all of the gowns and the bridal gown for, I don't know, 10 or 15 different bridal parties. So I always remember her doing fittings in the house. She also has extensive knowledge of canning and gardening, any type of putting food by, preserves, jams, jellies, and my mother's pies. I think the only response is just to take a moment of silence for my mother's pies. My mother also knows baskets and basketry. She knows beekeeping. And currently, her big project is keeping chickens. I believe she has nearly 50 chickens on her property in Hunterdon County. She still lives in Hunterdon County. And she sells the eggs, she keeps the chickens, and she has a big job keeping them safe because there are a couple of resident bears in the area who are always on the lookout for a chance to get at those chickens. My two younger sisters were also involved in crafts and crafting. It varied what they were interested in as we were growing up, but currently they are very involved in beads and beadwork, in painting on eggs with wax and different kinds of pigments, in sewing, embroidery, in paper, crafts, bookmaking, and all different kinds of sewing techniques. What was I crafting when I was growing up, you might ask? And the answer is nothing much. Although it was impossible to be raised by my parents and not have a deep appreciation for things that were handmade, I didn't really get involved in doing a lot of things by hand. I was always quite bookish and not inclined to have a mess or have to clean it up. And one thing I noticed about all of the crafting was that it involved an incredible amount of supplies and there was a lot of cleaning up to do. So while I always appreciated things that were handmade, especially handmade gifts, I was not really involved in the make-it-yourself, do-it-yourself movement that was going on full bore in the household where I grew up. That is until about 5 years ago when the professional development program at the school where I work was offering something through its wellness program called Crochet for Stress Relief. I hadn't signed up, of course, but my friend Renee had signed up, and then she launched about a two-week campaign pressuring me to sign up for this four-session class, Crochet for Stress Relief. So finally, I relented, and I did, and I really enjoyed the class. I don't know what it was about crochet in particular or the fiber arts that grabbed my interest. When I think back, I did have an early introduction into spinning and drop spindling. We used to visit a cousin of my father's who had a sheep farm in upstate New York near Bainbridge. And we would go each February or March, and that's when lambing would be happening, and we would listen all night in the house until the wee hours of the morning. We would be listening to these baby monitors, and they would have the twin monitor outside in the barn. And as soon as we heard the sheep going into lamb, we would all go outside, and I witnessed several births of little baby lambs. And of course, my cousin Lisa was involved in all kinds of fiber arts. She had spinning wheels and huge looms, and she dyed a lot of her fiber. She also got involved in some of the fancier breeds of sheep, and I'm not sure about alpaca. I know she had a few llama one time when we were there. My mother just uncovered a couple of drop spindles that she must have given us and some of the yarn and fiber that we had been playing with. And working at those drop spindles, she must have given us just a rudimentary lesson on how to use them. So it was there in my early years, but it never never caught on. And somehow later on in life, when I was reintroduced to the fiber arts, I became smitten. And I think there are a few reasons for that when I reflect and think about it. One thing is that working in education, it's difficult to see tangible results sometimes. That can be a kind of stress or frustration, no matter how much you love the job. And I do love the job. But sometimes you don't really see a lot of growth, or you don't see particular indications of your influence. When you are able to craft or make something and you can point to that thing and say, look at that scarf, I made that start to finish, there is a certain kind of satisfaction in that. Another thing is that crafting at the tea house is an entirely different experience than crafting during other times in my life. I feel incredibly inspired here. The more we work on the house and the more we set it up to reflect who we are and what we like to do, the more conducive the space feels to working on projects and working on things over an extended period of time. I kept crocheting for several years and making handmade gifts. And then last summer, it was about May, I guess, I decided that I wanted to knit an Entrelac scarf. That was the big project that I wanted to do. And having no idea how to knit, I relied on some tutorials, and I will link them in the show notes. The ones that I found very helpful for the Entrelac scarf are from verypink.com. She has a series on how to make this scarf with Noro yarn. It looks very impressive. It looks like you can do a whole lot of things with knitting when actually it's very simple. So that was my introduction to knitting. I kept knitting, and then once I started listening to and watching podcasts, I decided that I wanted to learn how to spin. So I took a class at the Spinnery in Frenchtown, New Jersey, which is very close to the home where I grew up. The owner and proprietor, Betty, is an amazing teacher. And I'll talk about that a little bit in the next segment. Betty had a 4-week class on the introduction to spinning, which I took. During the second class, she had us each sit in front of a spinning wheel that she had for sale in her shop. I sat behind a Louette. It spun like a dream. I thought it was very interesting the way the wheel looked like it was from IKEA or something and not an old-fashioned spinning wheel that looked like it was out of a production of Cinderella or something. Before the class was over, I had purchased the spinning wheel. It's now in my house and I spin nearly every week. And the last skill set that I've been practicing has to do with weaving, because my mother found a Becca loom in her attic. I took a quick lesson in how to warp that loom and just started weaving. So you'll hear a little bit more about some of my weaving adventures later in the episode. Well, that's the backstory of me falling in love with the fiber arts. My earliest introduction didn't seem to take, but when introduced to crochet and knitting later in life, I found that I really fell in love with it. One thing that's such a deep source of appreciation is that feeling of being able to create and give handmade items as gifts. That's such a luxury, and it's been so incredibly powerful for me as an adult to be able to do that. I find that I understand my upbringing better and better as I get older, and I become even more grateful for those values that my parents instilled in me, to appreciate what's handmade, to appreciate the time and the energy and the expertise that someone put into making something for you is a life lesson that I think every person should be able to experience, even if it's later in life. Yarn lover at large. Well, this is a segment in which I hope to provide the details of some places I visit. They could be local yarn shops or maybe festivals or other kinds of events where I'm doing something and learning something that I think is of interest. So last Friday, I took a spinning 2 class back at the spinnery, and my teacher was Betty, who had taught me how to spin. The class this time was a little bit smaller, and it was just a one session class, 10 to 1, on a Friday morning. And we learned a lot about wheel maintenance, which was very important, and also spinning techniques. And Betty really tried to tailor her information to the kinds of questions we asked, and she individualized her teaching for each of us. Betty is a phenomenal storyteller. And so one of the first things that happened when I walked into the shop was we started talking about the curse of the boyfriend sweater. I wasn't quite sure how it came up, but then all of a sudden she was in the middle of telling me this story. And the story is from one of her customers who I don't know, but she was retelling it, and I just think it's really charming. So to understand the story, you need to know about the curse of the boyfriend sweater, which knitters generally know. But if you're a non-knitter, the deal is that if you start knitting a sweater for a boyfriend, inevitably, before that sweater is finished, the relationship will be over. If you know a longtime knitter, you can probably hear a great boyfriend sweater story. Well, the corollary to that is the second sock, which was new to me, but this makes sense. And I guess there are a lot of stories about a second sock. Most people knit socks one at a time. And so when you're on the second sock or before you start the second sock, there's this thing known as second sock syndrome, where your spirit flags and your motivation is low because you've already knitted a sock, and who wants to start over and start knitting the same sock in the same pattern with the same colors? Well, if you fuse together the curse of the boyfriend sweater with second sock syndrome, you get the curse of the second sock. And so one of Betty's clients came in with this fabulous story about the curse of the second sock. It's only fabulous because it didn't happen to me. I'm sure it's really troublesome for the knitter in question. So the knitter in question has a son, a college-age son, I guess. And this son was dating, and he had been through several girlfriends, and the parents were not really very excited about any of the girlfriends that he had chosen until he brought this young woman home to meet his parents, and they really liked her. The mother, in particular, really liked this young lady, saw infinite possibilities for a long-term relationship and marriage, and she was just so lovely. And she seemed very interested in handmade things and knitted items. So the woman asked the young lady for her shoe size and said, "I would like to knit a pair of socks for you. Is that something you would like to receive?" Oh, yes, she would love it. And they talked about colors, and she had the young woman's shoe size, and she set about knitting these socks. She was about halfway through the second sock when the son called from college to say, "It's over. They were through. No more girlfriend." So the knitter is now, you know, working on these socks. They were rather a small size because the girl had small feet, so they wouldn't fit just anyone. She's on the second sock. What is she going to do with this sock project? They're not going to fit her. What's she going to do? So she had a coworker who she thought might be a similar shoe size. And she liked this woman a lot and really admired her. And so a few weeks later, she inquired at work, you know, "Would you be interested in a pair of socks? I'm making them in a small size, and this is the color." "Oh, yes, that would be lovely." So the woman went home, and that weekend she was working on finishing the socks. And by Sunday night, the socks are finished, and she packaged them up and brought them to work with her on Monday morning, where the recipient of this gift she found had transferred to another job at another university. Just over the weekend. Transferred. Just like that. And so now this knitter has a cursed pair of socks. It just seems like anyone she determines as the recipient for these socks is suddenly out of her life in some way, which I think is just a fascinating story and a great way to begin the class. All right, so back to the class. We went over several things about wheel maintenance at the beginning of the class, and this was of particular interest to me because my Louette had developed a pretty horrific and consistent squeak somewhere in the treadle section. Betty tried a number of things. Finally, we had to put the wheel on the operating table. We lifted it up onto a table she had in the back room of the shop and turned it over and really examined everything. There is a photo on my website for this episode of Betty and I working on my wheel, which is a great photo. And we identified the point of the squeak and applied a lot of sewing machine oil, which is what she has in a little squeeze bottle, to help lubricate all the different working parts of the wheel. That was of immense help to me. Other things I learned the difference between a flyer-driven versus a bobbin-driven spinning wheel. I learned that Louette wheels are bobbin-driven, and this is largely unusual. Most of the spinning wheel manufacturers make flyer-driven spinning wheels. One of the advantages of a bobbin-driven spinning wheel like the Louette is that it has a very large bobbin capacity. You can fit a great deal of yarn on that bobbin. I like that, and I like the idea of using the Louette that I have for anything from quite a fine yarn. I can get lace weight singles very easily on that spinning wheel, all the way up to a very lumpy, bumpy art yarn on the Louette. And part of that is the ease of use and the lack of fiddly parts with a bobbin-driven spinning wheel. And the other thing is the very large orifice size and very high capacity of the bobbin. Betty provided some excellent tips for troubleshooting when you're working at home with your wheel and there's no one around to help you out. She said, if you're having trouble with your wheel working properly, first, check to see that it's threaded properly. And you can solve a lot of problems by just going through either re-threading it or checking everything from the bobbin out to the fiber in your hand to make sure it's threaded properly. And the second thing to check is the tensioning. And you can do a little bit of tension adjustment once that bobbin starts to fill up so that it continues to draw as powerfully as it did when the bobbin was empty. But there really aren't a lot of fiddly parts to a Louette, which is one of the reasons I like it a lot. We talked about some techniques for continuing to get better as a spinner. And one thing Betty suggested, which had never occurred to me before, was to select a knitting project, to look very carefully at the specifications for the yarn, and then to spin the yarn you need for that project. What I had been doing was ordering fiber, spinning up the fiber into whatever it wanted to be, not really thinking very intentionally about it. And then once I had the resulting yarn, trying to figure out what I could make with that yarn. This way of being much more intentional is something I plan to do, and I'll talk a little bit more about that on the front porch segment. The final thing we all talked about as a class was this imperative to knit now with the yarn you're spinning now. I'm not sure where I had heard about this. Maybe I read it or maybe I saw it on a video podcast or something like that. Someone recommending that you try to use up all the yarn that you're spinning as quickly as you can. And the reason for that, particularly with beginning spinners, is that since your techniques are accumulating and your skill is increasing all of the time, it doesn't take very long for you to look back at a yarn that you made and think, oh, that's terrible. I could do so much better. And then you're never going to want to knit with that yarn because you see it as kind of a failure or a flop, or you see all the things that are wrong with it. If you just knit with it right away, it seems like great yarn because that's the skill level that you're at and that's the ability that you have. So if you knit that up right away, you won't be sitting around thinking, what am I ever going to do with this yarn? And so we had each been invited to bring in some yarn or bring in projects that we had made, and Betty would offer a critique. And after we went over some wheel maintenance, we went around in the room and did a little bit of show and tell with yarn and projects. And mine were almost all in projects because I took that lesson to heart and I tried to knit with my yarn as soon as I finish. I had a great time at the spinnery in Frenchtown. I can't wait to go back and take another class sometime in the future, or just visit and do a little shopping. This segment, Yarn Lover at Large, is one I hope to repeat often in the future. Next week, I'm taking a class at my local yarn shop, which is Mountain Knits and Purls in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. And I'm taking a class on a mudra necklace and bracelet with Laura Nelkin. So I hope to report back to you about that class in a future episode. On the back porch this week are two projects. The first is Shaylin. The pattern is by Lila Robb, and I knitted that shawl out of some hand-spun yarn. It was a loop bullseye bat in the Cicada colorway, and I spun that quite thin and chain plied it so I could get a transitional yarn. As I mentioned in the last episode, I had started knitting it with size 9 knitting needles, and I thought the knitting looked a bit sloppy. So I changed to size 6 and I was able to complete the entire pattern and had just a little bit of yarn left over. I really like the way the color transitions from the gray all the way out to the deep rust color at the edges of the shawl. It's currently blocking as I'm recording, but I hope to include some photographs of that on the show notes on my website. The second item that I completed this week was something that I had on my loom since late May or early June, I believe. It is a scarf, and I used a combination of hand spun and commercial yarn. The first time I learned how to thread a loom, to warp a loom, I used hand spun. And very quickly, as I started to weave a project, I realized that the handspun singles were just too weak and they were going to snap and break or wear out very quickly into the weaving. And at that point, I did not have enough skill as a spinner to be spinning applied yarn that would be thin enough to warp my loom. So I started by using commercial yarn to warp the loom, and I continued that in my second project. And then I used hand spun for the weft. In this particular case, I used Into the World in the Lavinia color that I had spun up for the Knittables spin along with Diane of Knittables. And I had separated the colors in the Into the World fiber into groups and spun them up so I had a transitional yarn that resulted. And I'll include photographs of this so that you can see. I use the transitional yarn as the weft for the scarf, and the colors work from a very deep teal through a seafoam blue color through browns and then golds, and it really shows off the Into the World Lavinia colorway to very nice advantage. Completing one project on the loom makes me want to start another, and I have an even greater reason for wanting to start again because I did that entire project with my loom warped upside down. I don't know how I did it, and I had assistance with warping the loom, but somehow I was holding the entire loom upside down and had everything going kind of backwards. So I needed to do a great deal of work as I was weaving to make the loom operate correctly. And now I just want to start another project right away so that I can prove to myself I can do it correctly. It also makes me think about how to spin yarn specifically for weaving and how spinning yarn for weaving is different than spinning yarn for knitted projects. Also on the front porch is the idea I picked up in the advanced spinning class of spinning intentionally for a particular project. The project I have in mind that I mentioned in a previous episode is Batade by Stephen West. This is a circular shawl. It's closed, so it's contiguous and doesn't have open ends. It uses two different kinds of yarn and two different colors. And I plan to spin the main color and then purchase commercial yarn for the weft contrasting color. I need a fingering weight, so I plan to spin quite thin for a 2-ply fingering weight. And I plan to spin fractally. The fiber I'm using comes from BZB Fibers. It's a mixed BFL. And so the color takes differently on the lighter fiber versus the darker fiber, some of which barely takes the color at all. And so the resulting yarn has a very nice heathered look. The colors are greens, reds, and purples, very deep earth tones. And I will wait to see how that yarn looks before I purchase the contrasting color. I need, I think, about 470 yards, so it's going to require spinning quite thin. I've already started on that intentional spinning project today, and we'll see how quickly I can get the spinning and the knitting done in time to wear that garment, perhaps for Rhinebeck. We'll see how it goes. Double happiness today is lemons. One of the most important things I've learned about cooking is that if you want to amp up the flavor of just about anything, add lemon juice and add salt. And I've used lemon juice and salt in 3 different applications over the course of the past week. I'd like to tell you about them. Maybe you already know, or maybe they'll inspire some cooking of your own. The first use of lemons is in an eggplant dip that I made. I purchased an eggplant at the farmer's market. I cut the eggplant into 1/2-inch slabs. I coated both sides with olive oil, brushed it on with a pastry brush, and roasted them in the oven until the eggplant was tender. Then I let that steam a little bit by putting another layer of foil over top and a couple of kitchen towels, and letting the steam work on the skin of that eggplant. And I not very carefully peeled most of the eggplant skin away. I wasn't fanatical about getting every little bit. When the eggplant was completely cool, I put it into a food processor with most of a grated rind of lemon, all of the juice of one lemon, and some salt. The resulting spread is wonderful. It's great on crackers. It's great with tortilla chips. It's good on toast. I've been enjoying that all week. The second use of lemon is lemons in a bean salad. I made a 2-bean salad as opposed to a 3-bean salad. And I won't go through the entire recipe, but one of the things it called for was very thinly sliced raw onion. I used shallot instead, and any time I use a raw shallot or raw onion, I always put the thin slices in a small bowl of lemon juice for about 15 minutes before adding them to the recipe. I like a little bit of bite from a raw onion, but not a lot. And the final way I used lemons this week was to marinate a lamb steak. I used olive oil, salt and pepper, the entire juice of one lemon, and the entire grated rind of one lemon, and quite a bit of fresh rosemary, and slathered that all over a lamb steak and let it marinate overnight. It was about 24 hours before we put it on our charcoal grill and grilled that up. Lamb steak is typically served a bit on the rare side. It was tender, it was delicious, it was fragrant. I highly recommend that you grill a lamb steak this summer while you still have the chance. Thank you for listening. The music in today's episode is So Wheat, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas and performed by Chris DeLong and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Jump a river naked, hike a country mile, it's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.